It's Monday, 20 November 1989. This is an oral history interview with Glenn Evans, conducted by Arnold Thackeray at the Salk Institute in San Diego. And Glenn, will you start us off by talking a little bit about your family background?
Okay, well, let's see. My grandfather was born in Swansea, South Wales, where the Evans name comes from. And he came to the United States when he was about 10 or 11 years old, and settled in the Midwest near Chicago. He then ran away from home when he was about 15 and joined the Canadian Army and fought in World War I. When he returned from that, settled in St. Louis, where he met my grandmother on my father's side. My father then was born in St. Louis, and as a teenager migrated to San Diego, where he settled and remained the rest of his life, and where he still lives. My father was until he retired, was an illustrator who began working in an aircraft company during the war, doing designs and illustrations for airplanes. And then as time went on, became more involved in engineering aspects besides just the drawings. And finally, before he retired, ended up doing some of the design drawings for the space shuttle. And in fact, for a while, one of his drawings was in the Smithsonian in Washington, the space shuttle. And he's now retired and lives in San Diego.
What was his highest level of education?
Oh, he graduated from high school and went to, I think he was in college for 1 year before, so he never finished college, so he attended college for about a year, where he took primarily art and design classes, and both, for whatever reason, never continued, partly because of the necessity of working, partly because of the working during the war in the aircraft industry and various things like that. My mother also, her family originated also in the Midwest, actually in Arkansas, but moved to California much earlier than that. She was born in Bakersfield, which is in California, and moved to San Diego sometime during her early life. And essentially has worked, has been a homemaker. And she also attended college for 1 year, though never finished. So let's see, my family life, I'm the oldest of three children. My younger sister, who's 3 years younger than I, is currently a graduate student at University of California, San Diego in the communications department, where she's finishing her PhD this year, and works on the sociology of media. Her specialty is Cold War ideology in television.
A lively field.
A very lively field. Extremely interesting, though I don't understand very much of it. My younger brother, who's 10 years younger than I, and my sister obviously graduated from UC San Diego with a bachelor's degree, got a master's degree at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, and getting a PhD from UCSD. My brother, who's 10 years younger than I am, graduated about 2 years ago with a bachelor's degree in computer science from UCSD. He now works as a computer programmer and engineer for a small company in Sorrento Valley here called Quantum Design. And they make something called a squid magnetometer, which until recently I didn't know what that was, but it's a device for measuring superconductivity. So he now, his main occupation is flying around the world installing software on these large physics machines.
UC San Diego features very largely in
In our family, yes. Partly because it's local, partly because it's a great university, and also partly because it's a California state school, so it is somewhat less expensive to attend. And in fact, all three of us have really we have put ourselves through college, so we've each worked during our college years and ended up paying for most of our education ourselves. So our parents really have contributed some.
Was there a lot of family support? Where was the family push coming from, do you think? Three children heading through is...
Well, it's hard to know. I think both my parents have always very highly valued education. And my mother has probably been the driving force more than anything for her, kids attending college and then completing it. But I think in most cases it's more of an inner drive. I mean, it was very clearly understood from early age that each of the children would attend college, and then once we were let go, I don't think there was any difficulty in just continuing through it.
So the family is still, all the family is in the area?
Yeah, let me think. My parents are still here. My brother, and he was just recently married last month, and his wife lived here. My sister and her husband and her child live in San Diego. I have two grandmothers, both a paternal and maternal grandmother, who live in San Diego. And until the deaths of the grandfathers, they both lived here as well. As well as my mother's brothers and several other cousins. So I think there's very little of our family that is elsewhere. Now, in the case of the children, each of us have spent some time in other parts of the country. My sister went to graduate school in Massachusetts. I was an intern at Stanford, and I spent some time at the National Institutes of Health in Maryland. But I think in terms of why we've all ended up here, it's partly out of choice, because I think to all of us it's very important to be near family, and particularly in my mind, having children, it's very important to me that my children grow up knowing their grandparents on more than just a once a year basis. So that's clearly by choice that we kind of ended up back in the same area.
Just staying with the family for one more minute, if I may. What is the religious affiliation of the family?
Well, my grandmother is a very devout Catholic. My father was raised as a very devout Catholic, though is not as devout as his parents were. My mother was always a Protestant derivation, though not particularly religious. And my brother recently married a girl of Polish extraction, and though he was never really educated or brought up as a Catholic, has now gone back and become very religious again. So he's just been confirmed and so on. My sister, while being brought up in this very loosely Catholic family, married a Greek man. And she has then converted to Greek Orthodox. And in fact, their wedding was in the Greek Orthodox Church. And I think there's really not a great religious drive in myself or in my close family or really in my parents. So I think it's the religious interest, I think, kind of drops off with the grandparents. My wife was brought up in the Lutheran Church, and my children actually are not being brought up in a strictly religious home, though they're being exposed to a lot of religious ideologies and ideas, partly because my wife is a musician and she sings both in a church and in a synagogue. And while she, her background is Lutheran and mine is Catholic, she sings in a congregational church, and we have a lot of friends of various backgrounds, so I think neither of them are particularly religious, so I think that it's good for the children at least to know something about religion.
Let me track back into your own education, if I may. When did science begin to seem the likely way to go?
Well, I think probably, I mean, during high school is when I, you know, first had any kind of formal education in a science as a science, and where I really became interested in it, predominantly probably as a sophomore in high school, taking biology and then chemistry and then physics. And there were lots of activities like science fairs and various things that I participated in. And so when I was actually in somewhat of a unique circumstance, because being in San Diego as a senior in high school, I was able to take courses at the University of California, San Diego. In fact, was actually admitted to the university while I was in my, as I was beginning my last year of high school. And that year I took a number of courses in computer science, which was in my first main interest. And then once I became a full-time student here, it was quite clear that I was going to be involved in some science, though it was not completely clear which.
Was that high school linkage, was that common? Were other people doing it?
No, it was the high school that I went to, which was a public high school, but I was the very first class. It was a new high school in a new area, and it was designed to be experimental. Their initial few classes had a program that was very flexible. It allowed students to proceed at their own pace. It encouraged them to decide their own curriculum and pick out areas they were interested in. It allowed them the flexibility to actually leave the high school campus and take courses either at junior colleges or at university. I think that program only lasted one or two years, actually. Whether it was successful for the majority of students, I don't know, but it allowed me the ability to do things that I think very few other students did. In fact, I think I was the only student that took any courses at UCSD, though there were several that took things at junior colleges.
Was a particular teacher urging you to do that?
There was one who was actually the vice principal, a counselor, who was the driving force behind this experimental program. His name was Hermanson. He was a recent Harvard graduate, a very young guy, had a doctoral degree in education, was very interested in new programs and very active in this area. And this whole concept was really his driving force. And he was a person that encouraged students to do a lot of these things. So it was, I wouldn't have thought of doing that on my own, I'm sure, of even being able to know how to arrange such things. But with a little bit of provocation and someone showing you the way, it was quite easy to go out and do such things.
So UCSD was more or less automatic, that's true.
Well, it was automatic partly because I was already a student. I didn't even have to reapply to college. Partly because it was local, and my parents, while they were very much encouraging the kids to go to college, it was really never considered that we would go away. And a lot of that, I think, was the expense in going to the East Coast to an Ivy League school. A lot of it was also because they had really never experienced very much of the university themselves. And it's still to this day not completely clear to them what the difference between the University of California and San Diego State College or junior college is. They see them all as pretty much equivalent in higher education. And again, as a high school student, one's not really one needs the parental direction to decide on those things. So it was pretty much understood that that's what I was doing. And in the long run, I think it worked out fine. One always has these insecurities about, you know, what would have happened if. But
how big was your high school class?
It was very small, and I, to tell you the truth, it was very small by a lot of standards. It was several hundred, but I can't tell you the exact number, to tell you the truth, off the top of my head. I don't really recall, because it was the very first graduating class of this high school, and virtually no one who was graduating had started high school there. We had all come from other schools in the area and pretty much been put together.
So you came here, and what took you in the biology direction? How did that go?
I was very much interested in biology and chemistry, and at the time, the year of my birth was the year that, or the year after was the year that the structure of DNA was discovered. And I'd actually had a little bit of the beginnings of molecular biology as a high school student, which was 10 years later. And the other thing that strangely enough made a big difference as to what I decided to do in college was that the year before I started college, which was 1970, I worked here for the summer at the Salk Institute, and there was a program at that time, and there still is, for local high school students to come into the lab and to do something, usually under the direction of one of the postdocs or someone in the lab. And this was actually originally designed as a program for minority, underprivileged high school students. And I was not necessarily a minority nor underprivileged, but at that particular year, they couldn't find enough students to fill up the places. So, again, I was pointed in this direction by this high school counselor and spent the summer here and ended up doing real benchtop the biology, knowing absolutely nothing about science. And it was pretty clear to me then that this was a really interesting thing to do. When I then went to college, it was clear that what I wanted to do was initially directed to either biology or chemistry. I was a biology major, but I actually fulfilled all the requirements for the chemistry degree as well, and took other classes, physics and mathematics and things, but really was primarily interested in biology after that, or at least what I consider to be biology, which was...
Okay.
So what I mean by biology is really molecular biology, which is really a combination of biology and chemistry.
And was that an organized entity on the campus at that time?
No, it was not. In fact, there was not even a biochemistry program or department. And there were courses in molecular biology taught through the biology department, but essentially anyone interested in that would go either to biology or to chemistry, and they would then take these other courses and focus themselves in that way. But my undergraduate degree is actually in biology. My PhD, which is the same area, is actually in chemistry.
When you were an undergraduate, did you get back into the lab somewhere in the summer?
I actually, when I worked at the Salk Institute during the summer, I worked actually in Renato Del Becco's lab, who's now the president of our institute, and I spent my time there. I actually came back a little bit during that fall and worked to finish up some of the experiments I was doing. I then, the following year, got a job in the chemistry department as a lab assistant, working for someone who was an inorganic chemist but was interested in applying those ideas and techniques to biology. So I was really working in the biochemistry area, and worked there throughout the rest of my college career. And was essentially working as a technician, not so much as a student. And I was paid. That's how I worked my way through college. And we published two papers, or I was a co-author on two papers during my time as an undergraduate.
Co-author with?
With the graduate student and the professor that I worked with. So I was essentially the laboratory assistant working with a graduate student.
So this was pretty unusual within your undergraduate class, wasn't it?
I think so. It was very usual for a lot of the students to have jobs. Usually they worked as dishwashers or media makers. I actually started working as a dishwasher, and I washed dishes for about 2 weeks. And then they actually found out that I had worked at the Salk Institute and had some other, had worked in the lab before, and I kind of worked on to doing more valuable things, or at least what was more valuable to them and also to me.
Okay. So, if I asked you about influences on you as an undergraduate, this sounds quite important.
Well, I think the people who probably were most influential as an undergraduate were, first of all, the people that I worked with at Salk was actually before I was a graduate, but Dr. Delbecco and the two postdocs that I worked with in the lab, John Newbold and Jim Shampoo, have now gone on elsewhere many years ago. And then Gerhard Schrauser was a professor who's still at UCSD that I worked with as an undergraduate. And probably a number of the professors, but more directly the people that I worked for. I think if there were one professor who in a more academic way really influenced me, it was the undergraduate chemistry professor that I had, whose name was Art Robinson, who was actually a protege of Linus Pauling. And by protege, Linus Pauling at that time was at UCSD and taught freshman chemistry, but then left to go to Stanford. And Art Robinson, who was his postdoc, stayed here and took over his classes and was a very good teacher. I thought he was very good. Not everyone thought he was, but he was extremely tough on the students, and that it was a very hard course.
How many students were there in your graduating group, biology majors and all?
Again, it's hard for me to tell you exactly the number. There were probably 200 or 300 of that major. The lectures of that major were these huge lectures. But again, in some ways, I was a little out of the ordinary in that I finished my undergraduate degree in 3 years, partly because I had several credits from when I was a high school student, partly because I ended up taking a lot of classes. And because I was interested in both biology and chemistry, when I was approaching the middle of my junior year, I was told by the administration that I had too many credits, and I could either do a double major in biology and chemistry and get two bachelor's degrees, or I could graduate a year early. And at that time, one of the great decisions of my life, which of these things to do, which probably in the long run wouldn't have made any difference whatsoever. But what I ended up doing was graduating a year early and then spending a year as a graduate student. And in fact, I initially went to the chemistry department because I was working for a professor in the chemistry department, and I could really, without changing very much. So I essentially graduated very prematurely from my point of view and wasn't really prepared for what I was going to do at the end of that time. And I think in the long run it was a good thing to do. So I spent a year as a graduate student. My original idea was to apply to medical school after 4 years. And so I graduated a year early and had already applied for a year later for medical school. And I mean, as you might see, that kind of rolled me in, so I ended up being educated at the same university, partly because I was not doing things the way we were supposed to.
The thought in going to medical school was what?
Well, the thought in going to medical school was predominantly, there was no question at that point that I wanted to do research, and research in an area like molecular biology. And after working in some other areas like inorganic chemistry, it was still pretty clear that's what I wanted to do. And so the question was whether to go do a PhD or to go to medical school and do it through an MD track. At that time, which was the mid-70s, was the time when the NIH was encouraging MDs to go into research. It was very easy to get research grants. Most of the things that I found very interesting and fascinating going on were going on in laboratories at the medical school.
You knew some people there.
I knew some people quite well. Jeff Rosenfeld, who became my PhD thesis advisor, in fact, I knew when I was an undergraduate. And he was a very young assistant professor of medicine who was working on hormone action. And it seemed to me that would be a way of not only being able to do the kind of research I wanted, but also being in a position of having a little more human contact and relevance to the work. That is, the things that were happening in molecular biology, recombinant DNA, and a lot of that was clearly something that was going to be of great medical use. And I now advise a lot of MD PhD students who are considering the same question. And I don't know what the right direction is, but I think they have to ask themselves, what do they see themselves doing in the future as to whether they should decide one or the other. So essentially, I ended up doing both by being in an MD PhD program, but much more along a medical line, I think, than a PhD.
And you felt retrospectively that was a good choice?
I think for me, retrospectively, it was a very good choice, not so much because I know or I do any clinical work, because I don't right now, but it very much changes the way you look at science. It changes the kinds of things you would do. So, molecular biology or biology is a very vast field. There are a lot of exciting things going on with Drosophila, yeast, the worm C. elegans. But while I'm interested in all those, I think that my approaches and interests and directions will always be very closely related to humans. So we'll be using human material or mammals of some kind. And that was actually something that Phil Leder, many years later, you know, told me, since he had done something similar, was that while he really didn't do clinical work, having a medical education had a vast effect on what he would, the kinds of problems he would look into and the kinds of ways he would approach them.
So what do you advise people now?
I think that particularly for people that would anticipate doing both degrees, an MD, PhD, which would be to train a medical researcher, is that it's very different than either being a clinician or being a PhD. And the reason is it will provide you with the training to do very high quality research, but it will educate you in medicine. And medicine is an incredibly vast discipline. There's a lot of facts to learn. And what you will have is someone educated as a doctor who knows how to do the lab research. That's a very special kind of person, I think. It's not for everybody. But if that's the kind of thing they're interested in doing, then I would encourage them to do it. I wouldn't encourage them to go into that because it will either be easier for them or they'll get paid more or something like that. I think they have to realize exactly what it is that will be training them to do.
How were you, you went through the MD and PhD in quick time.
Yes. Yeah.
How was that, was getting that financed a problem?
Well, the advantage for me being in, I was in an NIH-funded MSTP, or Medical Scientist Training Program. The advantage to me was that that paid the one stipend. So essentially it was a funded position. I also got a scholarship from the University of California, which was another one of the things keeping me here, which paid anything that other programs didn't pick up. So in fact, that funded my entire graduate career. There was attached to the, you know, this was funded from the NIH, and there was attached to that a payback agreement, which was that if the trainee decided not to do research as a career for what was then the equivalent number of years, then you had to pay them back the amount of money it cost. So that for me wasn't a problem, because it didn't change what I would do. But if I had changed my mind and decided to become a surgeon, then I would have had to pay them back the cost of my education.
Is that program still there?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Yes. Hold on a moment. So, taking an MD, PhD at San Diego had become almost foreordained by the time you
well, it,
were
it,
doing it.
It was actually not exactly planned, because when I applied to medical school, I applied to medical school with the thought of going elsewhere. In fact, I applied to similar programs at other places, and I think I applied to six places, and I was accepted to all six, which is Harvard, Johns Hopkins, Washington University, St. Louis, Columbia, UCSF, and essentially decided to stay in San Diego. In part because I would finish quicker that way, and also in part because the Regents Scholarship would fund me. And one of the disadvantages to some of the other programs is, in order to be in their MSTP program, you had to first finish the medical school and start, and then apply to that in your second year. So there wasn't the assurance you would actually be part of it. Whereas here, I was already doing it. I was already in the graduate program. One of the kind of curious things about that is the way I, not planned, of course, but the way this worked out, neither the graduate school nor the medical school knew that I was actually in the other school. So they actually thought there were two people with the same name. And the problem came about when the chemistry department wanted me to do my oral qualifying exam. And I told them I couldn't do it. I was taking pathology in the medical school. And then they realized, this was before the program had actually started, they realized that it was the same person. And they incorporated me in as the first official member of this MSTP program. So I actually ended up being in two departments simultaneously without the other one knowing about it.
Quite a juggling feat, wasn't it?
It wasn't intentional. I didn't go out of my way to do it. But it was quite unusual.
Kept you quite busy, didn't it?
It was very busy.
Will you talk just a bit more about those graduate student and MB years?
Well, essentially, the equivalent of my senior year of college, where I was a first-year graduate student, I took the courses I was interested in biochemistry and did quite a bit of lab work. At that point, I decided to work in Jeff Rosenfeld's lab at the medical school for my thesis work, and I began working on the activation of hormone genes and pituitary by other hormones. I was looking at the regulation of gene expression. This was just at the point where, it's actually slightly before recombinant DNA became a possibility. We were looking at messenger RNA levels using various techniques, and as other people were beginning to clone things, beginning to pick up on some of the ideas of how to do that. And then the next year, when I began as a medical student, I had a huge amount of coursework to do. And the first year actually went by okay. Towards the end of the first year, beginning of the second year, I realized that I was really not interested in everything they were teaching. So I ended up not going to class a lot of times, and I'd work in the lab. And as long as you passed the tests, there was no problem. So I ended up spending a lot of the time where I should have been doing gross anatomy, actually doing experiments in the lab.
So how did you pass the test?
I found actually that I could pass the test much easier by reading the books and studying than I could by going to lectures, and that some of the lectures were not very exciting or illuminating, and a lot of the students would spend all their time in class and really have very little to show after being in the class. And it was pretty easy, since this was a body of knowledge, not really anything being generated new, and not really teaching one how to think to solve problems. It was fairly easy. I say this in retrospect, it was a lot of work, but to learn the material fairly efficiently. Then after the first 2 years of medical school, I then, which was planned in this program, took the time off, became a full-time graduate student, And by that time I had enough work done and projects of my own going that I could finish in about a year and a half, I think. I finished my thesis work, went back and did the required clinical rotations, and finished both at the same time.
And your thesis was?
My thesis was on the regulation of prolactin gene expression by the hormone TRF. TRF was a small peptide hormone of three amino acids that was the first releasing factor, the first hormone released by the brain within control of the hormones. And it was actually discovered by Roger Guillemin, who was a professor here at the Salk Institute, who won the Nobel Prize for that discovery. So it was not only an exciting area to be working, but having this very distinguished scientist across the street who actually initiated that study was very awe-inspiring.
And this was in the chemistry department, right?
It was in the chemistry department, though my work was actually done in the medical school. And the reason it was in the chemistry department was partly for the following reason. In the medical scientist program, one could choose any department that one wanted to do one's thesis. Most of the students chose biology because it fit closer with what they were doing. Because I started in the chemistry department, the only requirement the chemistry department really had was to pass four examinations in four fields: physical chemistry, organic, inorganic, and analytical chemistry. And most of the students didn't choose that because if they didn't pass physical chemistry, they had to take classes in it. And I happened to pass all four of them, so I didn't have any course requirements in that department. So it made really no difference to me to be in chemistry, even though what I was doing as a thesis was not really chemistry. It was really molecular biology.
You mentioned you did a couple of publications as an undergrad.
Yep.
Were you publishing as this work was going along, or not?
As the undergraduate work?
No, while you were in medical school and doing graduate work.
When I was in graduate work, I think the first paper I published from that was at the end of my first year of graduate work. And then as time went on, there were, I think 8 or 9 different papers that we wrote on various aspects during graduate work, some of which were primary research and some of which were review articles. We being myself and my thesis advisor. So what actually happened is I ended up doing the work and then writing the papers, and then he would edit, tell me where I was wrong, things like that.
Was that a relationship a particularly crucial one?
I think so. It was. It was and still is a very important relationship, not purely from a scientific point of view, but also I think on a warm personal basis. Partly because I had known I wanted to do molecular biology. In the chemistry department, I began working in the area of inorganic chemistry because that was the person that I worked for as an undergraduate. In the first few months as a graduate student, I actually continued that with the thought of becoming an inorganic or bioinorganic chemist. And it became very clear to me very quickly that that really wasn't the area I wanted to work in. So I was then struggling with picking up, leaving one lab, well, on good terms, not necessarily, I was leaving voluntarily, but it wasn't, they would have liked to have me stay very much, and I needed to find another lab I was interested in. My girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife, worked at the medical school for a secretary in the endocrinology department, and we were talking about where I should go, what I should do, and she said, you have to go talk to this young guy, Jeff Rosenfeld, who has just come as an assistant professor. And I went to talk to him, And I was so excited by his enthusiasm and what he was doing that I then began to work in his lab and ultimately stayed there. And I was his first graduate student. Most students would hesitate to go into a lab and work for someone that has no track record, has never done really anything in science. And I think part of that was just the enthusiasm that he had himself and still has and inspired in me. And I think in the long run it was a good choice.
So run me forward now, what happens as you graduate?
Well, then as I was graduating, there comes another great decision point in one's life in that kind of a program. Do you go and be a clinician for several years and do the internship residency clinical approach? Or the opposite is to say I want to do the PhD side of my life and go off and do a postdoctoral fellowship and then look for basic science positions. And at that point, no one is really sure what to do. The decision I made was to go ahead and do, at least try being a clinical doctor. I'd never done that before, except as a medical student. And I thought, if I'm going to decide not to do that for the rest of my life, I better be darn sure that I know what it is I'm not going to do. So I applied for internships and decided to go to Stanford, partly because it was, in my mind, a more intellectual atmosphere. The hospital and the basic science departments were in the same building. And so I went as a medical intern in the Department of Internal Medicine and did all the usual things interns do, stay up all night for 3 weeks at a time. But it's clear my love was really in the laboratory and not in the clinic, though I actually enjoyed clinical medicine and was quite good at it. But I'd also been trying to figure out what to do at that point. And I had applied to Phil Leder's lab as what was then called a medical staff fellow at the NIH. And that was a postdoc for MDs. And he accepted me into his lab or his department. And I found out about the acceptance about the same time I was starting my internship. Spent a month doing that and said, nah, I'm going to, you know, go to the NIH at the end of this year. So I finished up the internship year, which allows one to become licensed as a physician. And at that point, moved to the NIH. And with the idea that I'll spend a year or two doing research and then maybe eventually we'll go back and do some more clinical work. But after being in that environment for a few months, it was very clear that that's really what I wanted to do. And that's what I've been doing ever since. The other thing that was a big change for me in going from both medical school and as an intern and then to the NIH was in the earlier two experiences, I was very unusual. There was virtually nobody else with the background that I had or with the interests that I had. And in medical school, most of the people wanted to go into private practice, and there were only very few students interested in research. At Stanford, working in the hospital, there was virtually no interest. Everyone was interested in the patients, number one, and their real estate ventures, number two. And then when I went to the NIH, virtually everybody in the lab had the same background and the same enthusiasms that I did, because the lab was full of MD-PhDs who wanted to work in the lab and who had almost the same kind of background that I did. So it was like coming home. It was a really exciting time.
That was good, not depressing.
That was very good to me. It was nice to find kindred spirits where I had come from. There really wasn't any kind of kindred spirit. It also gives you a lot of reassurance that, you know, people value what you do. You're not really so unusual.
And that position at NIH, that was carried funding with it.
Yes, that actually was a one of these unusual positions that has since been discontinued. where one is appointed a commissioned officer in the military, in the Public Health Service, which has a Navy rank with it. It became very popular during the Vietnam War as a way to keep physicians who didn't want to go into the military out of the military. And it also paid a lot more than the usual postdoc, so it was a regular job, but it was at the MD, at a clinical level for a young clinical person. And it had some other, we could go to the officers club at the Navy hospital across the street and get in, because we were officers and get these little cards that we would show them. And there are a few people who were in my same group then who are now still at the NIH, and they're now captains or something, you know, lieutenant commanders or something. But they don't make any more appointments and that kind of thing. So one of my greatest pleasures in moving back here was showing everybody my little Geneva Convention card, which says on the back that if you're captured by the enemy, you only have to give your name, rank, and serial number.
What about the research that was going on in this lab? And
well, the thing that attracted me to that lab was primarily the work that Phil Leder and his colleagues had done on essentially solving the problem of antibody diversity, which is how one can make a virtually infinite number of antibodies from only a few genes. And that was a major enigma. And the solution to that, of course, is that the genes rearrange in development, which no one had predicted, but which turns out to be an elegant mechanism for doing that. And a number of labs, Susumu Tonigawa, who's actually he was a graduate student at UCSD at the same time I was an undergraduate, won the Nobel Prize for that. A lot of us think that Phil Leder should have shared it with him, but the Nobel Committee didn't agree. But the piece of work, in essence, was to show that genes recombine. And that discovery was made and published immediately before I began looking for places to go. And you know, I found that one of the most exciting scientific discoveries that one could conceive of, because it was so elegant and so simple and such a beautiful mechanism. So that was really the work that stimulated me to look in those areas. You want me to keep?
Yeah.
Okay, keep talking. So when I entered the lab, it was at a transition point for that group. Phil Leder was a department chairman who had a number of other people in his department that he worked with. His laboratory worked on immunoglobulin genes, and when I decided to go there, that's what I had thought I wanted to work with. And when I got there, the first thing I realized is the lab was very big. There were a lot of people working on various aspects. And the major problem of immunoglobulin diversity had been solved. In fact, there were a lot of other things that were interesting to work on. But the real beauty is in the one elegant mechanism. And at that time, John Seidman was a postdoctoral fellow of Phil Leder, had just finished and was offered a job at the NIH, accepted that in the same department. And his idea was to begin to look at major histocompatibility antigens, and that is a class of proteins that determine tissue type. It determined whether skin grafts would be accepted or rejected between different mice, and very little was known about that. So I essentially, after talking to a lot of people in the department, decided to work with John, because I thought that was such an important problem and also had the potential for really uncovering something really unique. So I went there actually to work on one problem, and within a few weeks switched around to doing something else. And I think in the long run that was a good decision. I'm still fascinated by histocompatibility antigens. And at that time, no one had applied molecular biology to that problem, and we were some of the first people to clone and understand the structure of those genes.
What at that moment, you were still fully funded, and describe the lab structure to me, the number of people,
well,
and
the lab,
the nature of the group.
The laboratory was called the Laboratory of Molecular Genetics, which is a department that had Phil Leder as the head and about six other investigators. Phil had a group that was very large, probably about 20 to 25 people, and occupied about half of the entire department.
When you say people, how many of those were?
Oh, probably 12 to 15 doctorate-level postdoctorals, several technicians, one graduate student, in fact, who's also a Pew Scholar now, Phil Heater. And in fact, a postdoc, Jeff Ravitch, who's also a Pew Scholar. And then various other visiting scientists who were there. So the entire number of people in that group was about that. The remainder of the people, the principal investigators, would have maybe one or two people in their lab. John Seidman, when he started his lab, initially had two people, maybe three, but I came at almost the exact time he started his own lab. So initially, he was the principal investigator, and there were two postdoctoral fellows, myself and David Margulies. And then soon thereafter, two more came. But the group was essentially five people at that time.
So you were in a little spin-off group from this?
We were in a little spin-off group, but it was enough.
It's almost like cell division.
No, it is, but it was also very integrated. And the lab meetings that we would have would be the entire group, Phil Leder's and John Seidman's. So we would present our findings and talk about our work with all the people working on immunoglobulins and also people that were working on oncogenes at that time in Phil Leder's group. So we actually had the best of both worlds. We had all the connections and the contact with this world famous group, yet we weren't just one of, you know, 20 people all doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. At least from my mind, that was an advantage.
How is that sort of scale thing playing out? Do you see any changes in the business in the time that you've been in?
I think that there are changes, and that it's more difficult, at least in my mind, it's more difficult now to work with a small group than it was at that time. Part of that is, I think science in some ways moves in waves. And when a new technology is developed or a new approach or new ideas, there's a wave of activity. For instance, DNA sequencing or protein sequencing, when that was derived, and DNA sequencing, where all of a sudden a lot of things that were difficult before become very easy, and there's a huge amount of activity. And then it dies down over a period of years because one's waiting for the next breakthrough. And what I see now is, in some ways, some of the things that were easy before, you know, are passé, but there's this new set of things on the horizon, and that one of the things it requires are more people, larger groups. The other thing it requires is automation.
You're talking about what's on the horizon?
Well, what I see on the horizon, if I guess I can step back and explain this, one of the major discoveries that affected the way I look at things was first the structure of DNA. And after that, there was a flurry of activity in uncovering RNA and tRNA and many different things. And it began to slow down in the mid-1970s, recombinant DNA. And then instead of, we could clone genes, and we could begin to look at individual genes in detail. That's been going on now for 15 years or so. It's beginning to slow down. And now what's on the immediate future is the idea of analyzing entire genomes at once. And it's an increase of several orders of magnitude in scale. I say this partly because one of the things we're very heavily involved in now is how to map chromosomes, not just single genes. And so I can optimistically anyway, foresee that in 10 years the kinds of things we do will be completely different than what we do now. We'll be dealing with millions of bases, not just thousands of bases. But in order to do that, we don't yet have all the tools that we need. We're developing, we as the scientific community in general. But those kinds of approaches now require a lot of people. You can't do it with just one or two people. It requires a lot of hands and different kinds of expertise.
Do you see that impinging on how life goes on at Salk, for instance? Can you see it?
I think it clearly will impinge on how an institute like this works, because there's a lot of talk about cottage industry versus big science. I think there will still be cottage industry, which is what we do now, but I think it's moving towards the idea of teams working rather than individual investigators. It's not that the individual investigators can't work very effectively, but they have to work by coming up with entirely new creative ideas. If they want to do the same kind of thing everybody else is doing, it requires more people. I actually would rather be doing, you know, the clever things that one or two people would be doing, but it's difficult to come up with an entirely new approach.
Can you see, can you actually see changes in the organization of the structure here and elsewhere, and in the size of the groups, in the number of people in the cottage? We all look at clouds on the horizon, yeah, and wonder, but yeah.
This institute is actually a good example of the kinds of changes that occur. When it was first founded in 1965, early 1960s, and was built and people were recruited to come here, there were really only six labs. There were six fellows of the institute who were scientists of very high reputation, who had very, very large groups. And Renato Del Becco's lab, for instance, who was the person I originally worked with when I was in high school, was a group that took up this entire floor, or the floor above us, but it was an entire wing, and probably 50 people. What happened was that turned out...
Sorry.
Can I take
sure.
one quick break?
Okay.
So there were several very large groups. One of the more successful ones was Roger Guillemin's group, which was probably at least 50 people, but that group was responsible for starting an entire new area of science, the area of neuroendocrinology. They were the group that, as I mentioned, discovered releasing hormones, and Guillemin won the Nobel Prize for that. But in to do that, to purify these things, they collected 100,000 sheep hypothalamine in order to extract the substance, which is, you know, a very small piece of tissue. It required a very large group. So the institute was founded with that in mind. But as time went on, it turned out that many of those groups were financially not very efficient, and that they got very large, but they weren't very productive. They weren't very productive in bringing in grants. And for a while, the Salk Institute was in serious financial trouble because of these large commitments. So it then moved to the idea of the small laboratories, one investigator with a few people, which is now what the majority of the institute is. And the idea was that those were more productive per capita. They were also more financially feasible. You could raise more grants for these small groups. And I think that's probably true. But I almost see it now moving in the other direction, which is to compete on some of these larger projects, which is really the direction molecular biology is moving. It's moving towards a larger group again. So it's almost evolving back. I'm not sure it's going to be only six laboratories, but you can see a change.
So Salk actually was in big science almost before it was there.
It was in big science from the beginning.
Yeah. Okay. Let me take you back into NIH and your little group. And, mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about what you were doing there, and were those years, where are the crucial break points in intellectually in what you've been doing?
I think the approach that one had at that time, and probably still true, is one can define what the problem is. That is, what piece of biology do we want to understand? And what that requires is understanding the structures of the proteins and the genes that are involved in it. And then from a technical point of view, in order to do it, one has to clone the gene. So the entire search or effort is to clone the gene. It's getting easier as time goes on because there are many newer techniques. But at that time, the entire effort was to clone the gene for the major histocompatibility protein. And so when I went to the NIH, which was just after leaving a clinical internship, with all the insecurities that involves, being out of the lab for a year, not going into a new field, not knowing whether you can compete and remember all the things you have to remember, went into a lab that was very new. The director of the laboratory was about 2 years older than myself, so he was essentially a peer rather.
Essentially, we knew what the problem was, and we knew what we needed in order to solve it. But it was the critical clone, the critical reagent, was not at hand. So the first 6, 7, or 8 months was a very uncomfortable time of working very hard, trying a number of different approaches, some of which were utter failures, knowing that there was hot competition from the other laboratories, which was always a big consideration. You want to be the first to clone it. You don't want to read about it in Nature. And essentially, that was a great time, but it was also a very tough time because we didn't know if we were ever going to get it. And around Christmas time, in fact, we got a clone, which turned out to be the right thing. And that actually was the critical break point. After that time, everything went very quickly. We worked harder than ever, but it was very clear what to do, and everything went very smoothly. Before that time, we had no real sense that we would actually succeed. And the one thing I remember quite distinctly was we were not alone doing this. There were several other groups working on it. We got a clone, which we thought was the right thing, and another group at Harvard also got a clone that they thought was the right thing. And we actually arranged to exchange clones. And John Seidman, the lab director, while it was competitive, it was not hostile. There was a lot of good feeling and a lot of exchange of information. And I distinctly remember that one of the people from that group was coming to the NIH to give a seminar and was bringing with him the clone. We, of course, very much wanted their clone to see what it was. And
he walked into the lab and with John, and they were discussing, he was getting ready for the talk in a very relaxed way. And I remember he said, "Oh yes, I have an epiclone here," handed it to me, and walked out. And I immediately put it into the ice bucket, had everything set, ready to analyze it. Within 5 minutes, it was transformed in bacteria. And the next one day or 2 days later was Christmas Day, right? It was one of the few times I've gone into the lab on Christmas Day, pulled out the clones and began the analysis. And it turned out, in fact, to be right. But to show you the kind of mindset into which one gets oneself. And after that time, after Christmas, the beginning of the year, everything went very smoothly, very quickly, and I think we wrote 3 or 4 papers within the next 6 month to a year.
So that really put this little group and you on the map.
Exactly. It was that
this that was in your first year?
This was in the first year of my postdoctoral fellowship. Again, the period of time that I spent at the NIH was divided into 2 halves. And the first 2 years, I was in this group of people working after our initial clone very intensely on various aspects. And the group got bigger. There were other people that came that were working on other projects, not directly related to this. But about a year after I arrived, it was announced to all of us that Phil Leder had been offered and accepted the job of the chairmanship of genetics at Harvard, and he was leaving the NIH. And John Seisman announced that he had been offered a position there and was leaving also. And of course, everyone was all up. Some of the people that had come a few weeks before that announcement were quite upset because they were going to have to move again. And from my point of view, I was offered a position there in John's new lab. But because I'd already been there 2 years and was really considering after the 3rd year of going on and finding my own job rather than staying any longer, I decided to stay at the NIH. And what happened was that the entire department picked up and left. And there were maybe 3 or 4 of us that were the more senior ones that stayed in the same space. And that was actually the best year of the entire experience, because I had already learned a great deal. I knew all the techniques. I had all the facilities. And then my boss left, and I was left to myself. And it was great fun to actually run my own lab for the first time. And it was just me and another postdoc who was working on his project. But actually, most of the things that I was most proud of and found I thought were the most creative were done during that time. And at that time, I was then looking at jobs in various places, deciding where to go.
Was staying at NIH a real option?
Yes, I was offered a position as a equivalent of an assistant professor at the NIH in the new laboratory of molecular genetics, which was being reorganized after Phil Leder and his group left. And at the same time, I applied to a number of other places. I was recruited by the Salk Institute in part because I knew a number of people here from having been here before, and my thesis advisor, Jeff Rosenfeld, was at that time actually here at the Institute and was lobbying very hard to have them recruit me back. And so at that time, the real decision came, would I stay at the NIH or would I move and come to the Salk Institute? And that was another very difficult decision to make, which was the right thing to do.
Talk about that.
Well, the things I think that influenced me were partly not so much the Salk Institute, which I knew very well and had been at, but things changed so much at the NIH, at least in the building that I was in, because I was in the midst of this incredibly exciting, vibrant group of 2 dozen people exactly like myself, very enthusiastic, energetic, very bright people. And it picked up and left. And while it was fun to remain behind, it was also a void. And it was not as exciting, it was not as much fun to interact with the people next door because they weren't there anymore. There were new people coming in, but I wasn't sure what that group was going to be like. I knew who the new lab director was and someone I respect very much, but not quite in the same way. And in some ways, I was looking to where I wanted to be, who my next door neighbors were going to be, what my lab was going to be set up like. And I saw the two as fairly equivalent from an intellectual point of view. From a practical point of view, there are a lot of differences. The NIH is all internal funding, so you didn't have to write grants. On the other hand, your group was only as large as you could convince the administrative structure it should be. Whereas here, well, no one, you're essentially entirely on your own in terms of funding. You have freedom to do whatever you want. It's a very intellectually free area, and if you can write the grant to do it, you can do the experiment, which was somewhat different than the NIH. So I think they're very different places. This is also an extremely small institute, and the NIH, of course, is very large.
Is there a problem with being small?
As far as the institute, I think it has very great advantages, and that's my own bias, in that a small place has the potential of being extremely efficient in how it does things. And one of the things that is true of the Salk Institute that is not true of the NIH is the support facilities and personnel and purchasing department and photo labs and equipment labs and the building people that renovate lab spaces is incredibly efficient compared with the government or even, I think, a large university like the University of California. So that's a very distinct advantage. And the Institute's philosophy originally was to make a place ideal for doing scientific research. They have lived up to many of those things, I think. Maybe not every promise.
So you chose to come here. How many?
I'd also mention that there were also personal things that you know, my family being in California also had a little bit to do with it. My wife at the time was pregnant, and we were deciding not only where we wanted to live and where I wanted to work, but where we wanted to bring our children up. And I think that also played a big part.
Let me go to Salk for now. Your title was assistant professor, then associate professor. In that sense, how many faculty are there?
There are, I believe, about 36 principal investigators, meaning people with their own labs. There are several other faculty who have the title of staff scientists, who are faculty but within some other umbrella laboratory.
And do you know what all these people are doing?
Mm-hmm. I don't know the intimate details of exactly what it is, but I'm very interested in a lot of areas that are unrelated to what we do. For instance, one of the faculty members that I actually deal a lot with now, Ursula Belugi, is a neuropsychologist, and she studies American Sign Language and among the deaf. She also has been working with children that have a disease called Williams Syndrome. Williams Syndrome is a birth defect that leads to mentally retarded children, and they have a very strange looking, they're called pixie children, have a very strange looking face, but they have more advanced language ability than their peers. So she's very interested in higher cognitive functions, and I would at least like to think about ways that one can apply the kinds of things we know how to do to understanding that. I'm not sure that we have the tools for that particular problem, but I'm very interested in what I have a fair idea of what most of the people here do, but I don't profess to understand it in any great depth. Terry Sanofsky, who is the head of a new laboratory called Computational Neurobiology, works on neural networks, which is a mathematical way of it's actually a part of computer science. It's a way of linking objects to enable them to process information and to learn. So he's using that to make models of how the brain might function. we were actually thinking about how we could use that to solve problems of comparing DNA sequences, because it allows you to write a computer program that can learn in various ways. Whether it can be done, I'm not sure.
So you come to Salk, you this is the moment when you have to start funding yourself,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
So, and also deciding what you can do.
Well, both of those, I think, are important considerations. One of the things postdoctoral fellows always get very insecure about is what are they going to do when they go and start their own lab? And the most important thing is, can they take the project they're working on with them? Various labs have different philosophies on that. And one thing that can happen is you end up working on the same thing that you worked on as a postdoc, but now you're in competition with your old advisor rather than in collaboration. The other possibility is you decide to do something completely unrelated and have trouble getting a grant because you have no experience in that area. So Phil Leader's philosophy was always that the postdocs should start something entirely new and shouldn't work on the same thing he was working on, partly for his benefit, partly for their benefit. And he encouraged postdocs, as they're towards the end of their time, to think about other things and actually, you know, do a few experiments on other things before they left. Now, my advisor, John Seidman, and I talked about this with him before leaving to decide what to do, and he was of a similar philosophy that you should really work on whatever you're interested in, whatever you want to, but he's not going to give you your project. He's going to continue to work on it, so it would be somewhat competitive. So essentially what John and I decided is that I would write a grant on whatever I wanted to. He would continue to do whatever he wanted and work on those areas. And if we ended up being competitors, that's okay, but we, you know, maintain good relations. And what actually happened is that I wrote a grant on exactly that, got the grant, and then didn't do anything that I said I was going to do in the grant. I used it to do an entirely new area, and did very well at it. And what really matters to the granting agencies is that you do something interesting and creative along those lines, not that you do exactly what you said you were going to do. And John, on the other hand, got areas of interest in other directions and dropped that project entirely. So, in fact, neither of us ended up doing that, rather than both of us working on the same thing.
Who was the granting agency?
NICHD, Child Health and Human Development. And, in fact, when I wrote the renewal for that grant, what I actually proposed to do was to continue the analysis of some of the same kinds of genes that I had worked on as a postdoc, proposing models of how they might function. What I actually did was I did the same thing on a different class of genes, which we cloned ourselves, and which, you know, we weren't in any competition with. And then what the agency said when they reviewed it was that Dr. Evans did a very clever thing, in that he began to work on one area and realized that wouldn't answer the questions that he wanted to answer, and then applied the same technique to this other set of genes. And I was actually complimented for the fact that I had changed directions, not grossly, but at least redirected things in a way that was primarily what I was more interested in. And I think in the long run, it was a good thing. Mm-hmm. And that has actually been a very successful set of experiments.
That was a grant that started up in 83.
Started up in 83. And I wrote that grant actually while I was still at the NIH.
You also had a CAC grant in 83.
I had some funds from the CAC Foundation. That was actually arranged by Max Cowan, who's now the vice president of Howard Hughes, who used to be the scientific director at the Salk Institute. And essentially what happened was, which I remember quite distinctly, was I was here in my own lab, very small, had my first grant, and someone came that wanted to do a postdoctoral fellowship with me, and I said, well, I'd very much like to have you. I don't have any money to pay you, but I'll go ask. And I asked Max, being very naive at the time, didn't realize that one probably doesn't do these things in in polite scientific circles, but I asked him if there was any possibility of having funding for a postdoc for a year. And I remember his comments quite distinctly. He said, "Well, you're from the NIH. Let me show you how fast and efficient things can be done at the Salk Institute." And he picked up the phone, and within 10 minutes, I had a salary for this postdoc, which came from the Keck Foundation.
Mm-hmm, 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 mm-hmm. And indeed, will you talk about the three things, the size of the group you've mm-hmm. had over the years from then till now, the funding of the group, because mm-hmm. I see you've had multiple mm-hmm. funding, and what you've been up to.
Okay. The first thing, the size of the group, until very recently, this was a very small group, which consisted of myself, one postdoctoral fellow, one technician, who was actually Jeff Rosenfeld's wife, my thesis advisor, who has worked for me since I came here, and a number of graduate students. And I very much enjoyed dealing with graduate students. And while there aren't as many students here as there are at the university, there are a few, and I've always gone out of my way to try to attract them. Now, I'm not...
So you've had, what, one or two at a time? Or?
Four. I have four now, and I've had...
They're writing a thesis for you.
They're writing a thesis for me. They do all the thesis research.
You have your license to...
No, actually, I'm not, but I will be soon, but... we've managed to find our way around. The criteria for a student coming here is they have to really want to come here, because it's much more difficult for them than staying at the university. They have to...
So this isn't typical for Salk people either?
It's not typical for the senior Salk people. The senior professors all have adjunct appointments. The junior professors, none of them have adjunct appointments, because they don't make those easily anymore. So... they're now, I mean, I should have such an appointment as of the first of the year, but so far during the last year it has been very difficult, and the students have been selected in that they're willing to go around the system in order to arrange to come here.
It's a little bootlegging operation.
It's very much on a shoestring.
Mm-hmm. So you've really wanted to do it?
Oh yes, I very much enjoy students. And
what's the value added to you?
The practical value, which is really not very much, is that they stay longer than a postdoc. Postdoctoral fellowship is usually 2 years or 3 years. Students is usually 4 years or 5 years. But in actuality, they require such a large amount of attention and training that it really takes them a while before they can work in the lab effectively. The real, I think, value is that I enjoy teaching the students. They're much more willing to think about problems, and they're more willing to do some of the things I would suggest to them than postdocs. Postdocs are very, in general, focused on a particular problem. They want to grind out the work. They want to write the papers and begin looking for jobs. Graduate students are much more intellectual about it, actually. They're much more interested in the science for the science's sake. I find them much more fun to deal with. I think the real reason that there are students here is because I like having graduate students in the lab. So until recently, I've had only one postdoctoral fellow at a time, partly because I haven't, as a young assistant professor without a reputation, you don't have a lot of people knocking on your door. In the last year, for one reason or another, because the work is becoming very visible, there are a lot of people applying all the time. So I've had, it's quite the opposite. I have to pick and choose and be very careful who I have in the lab. And so now there are 8 postdoctoral fellows in addition to the graduate students and a couple more who may be coming. So just in the last year, the group has expanded quite a lot. Part of that is the attention that the work, when the work goes well, a lot of people want to come and help work on it. partly is the kind of thing we're now beginning to do requires more people than a very small group. It's shifting slightly to something else. As far as funding, the Salk Institute has no internal funding of any kind, so I pay my entire salary myself. I've always been worried about having a single NIH grant supporting you, and if you lose the grant, you have no funding whatsoever. So it was clear to me from when I originally came that I would have to have at least two grants, just so I could split things up that way. And so I have the initial grant, which I wrote before I came. The day I arrived, I started writing the second one, and I've been lucky in that they've been funded both times. And those have really supported the majority of the work. There have been a number of other smaller things. The March of Dimes has supported our work for the last several years. The Pew Award, actually, as I have told them in the past, the thing that's nice about it is not that it's a large amount of money or anything, but it's not, they don't tell you what to do with it. It kind of gives you a little freedom that you don't have with NIH grants, either to buy something or hire graduate students you couldn't have hired otherwise, and they don't really are not really looking to see that you do what you said you were going to do. I think they really want you to do something. They want you to do whatever you want to do with it. And there have been a number of other smaller grants that I've applied for. In general, what I feel now is it's such a lot of work to write an application that you might as well apply for a big one rather than a small one, because you have about the same chance of success. And you also find that you spend a large amount of your time writing grants, which I don't particularly enjoy, but it's part of the business. So while the lab was small, there have essentially just been these two grants that have supported it. As it's gotten larger, the postdoctoral fellows all have their own fellowships, which they right after they get here or before they come. So they're really essentially independently funded. The graduate students don't take a lot of funding, but I kind of get it off in one thing or another. And the real limitation we have is equipment, because the equipment is becoming so expensive. It's hard to get $170,000 for one microscope. So that I'm still working on, so how to figure that out. And now we're essentially funded by those same sources. We have another grant from the Department of Energy, which I got 2 years ago at the beginnings of the Human Genome Project. And that's what a lot of what our lab is now doing is related to. And I see that the funding for that is increasing. So that we actually began doing that work before that became such a visible thing, such a publicly exciting area.
I see you're on one or two committees now.
I'm on a number of those review committees and committees. Since this is a new project and it's very controversial, I seem to want to get everybody's opinion about what to do.
What's your sense of talk just about how that is going right now? Since,
well,
maybe 30 years from now, that
I'll tell you how it's going. It's very clear to those of us who are actually kind of in the nitty-gritty bench work that this project can really be done. There's no question. There's also no question in my mind that the rewards, scientifically and intellectually, are going to be far greater than anybody imagines. And they're among the kind of core of people who are actually in the doing of it. There's a great deal of enthusiasm. This is like I can imagine it was like the time before the first linear accelerators were started in physics. It's the beginning of a new way of approaching it. And we're very excited. I'm particularly excited about it. Not everyone shares that enthusiasm, not because they don't see the scientific benefits, it's because of the political and the cost involved. And what they see, and I can't say that I disagree, is that this will take a large amount of the of the budget for science funding, and it will put it into something that will undoubtedly take away from other people's projects. Now, a lot of the high-level administrators say that's not the case, that it really is a separate pot of money, but I don't think anybody is absolutely convinced of that. It is getting more difficult to fund research even without this project, and I think this may contribute to making it a little more difficult. On the other hand, if I were a clinician in the hospital and I was given a list of projects that I could say money should be put into based on what will come out to benefit my patients, I mean, I would put it into this project. There's no question about it. So there are a lot of areas of science that intellectually are very interesting, and they have the potential for generating things of great value. But this, there's no question it's going to generate things of great value. Yeah.
Is that argument going on in the committees that you're sitting on, or is that argument essentially over now? Is the other committee staffed with people who are believers?
I think this argument was going on several years ago, 2 years ago maybe. It's now, I mean, the project is going to be done. Unless Congress changes its mind, which is always a possibility, they're fairly convinced that this is an important area, that this magnitude of effort should go into it. And it's pretty much, not only is it decided that it will be done, there's a 5-year plan on how it's to proceed.
I use a Swansea metaphor and say you're very much at the coal face in this. So, how many players are there on like you, on your level of competence? How do you number your peers as opposed to simply people working in the field?
Well, I guess the way I would answer that is, from all the meetings I've been to, there probably are 30 people or so who are as interested in this as I am, and kind of at the same level, that give talks at all the same meetings, that have groups or are putting together groups and are generating enthusiasm to do it. And I'm not convinced they're all as focused, because a lot of them are, without naming names, are very senior scientists that are very well known in their field, but they're also doing a lot of other things. And in my mind, the people that are really serious, that clearly are going to do it, even if the government does cut back all the money, there's probably a handful or so. I think it's hard to gauge the numbers, because as we actually were involved in this long before there was any idea of how to fund it, because it was fun and it was an interesting approach and a new way to approach genetics. As the funding becomes apparent, a lot of other people kind of jump on, because it's clear that that's something you can get a grant to do. And I try to at least convince myself I'm not one of those. But I think it's important to do science because you're enthusiastic and interested in it, not just because you can get a grant to do it.
Where are the which are the other labs you would be looking at right now? Where is your hot competition?
Well, in this particular area, there's not as much competition directly. That is, people doing exactly the same thing, but people doing the same thing in different areas.
Okay.
And it's different because while it's competition for attention or for whatever, for public, for appreciation of one's peers, which is really what this amounts to, there actually is a lot of collaboration as we exchange things. The tools that you develop. So the tools that you develop are exchanged freely between, we essentially exchange things with everybody, even if they're working on the same thing. But the other areas in which there's a lot of geographical areas are St. Louis, MIT in Boston, Michigan, University of Michigan, UC San Francisco, Baylor College in Houston, where else? There are probably a few that I haven't thought of. There's a group at Harvard besides a group at MIT. Those are the areas where people have an active, ongoing program and really very well into the work.
What about, do you look overseas in the same way?
Yeah, in this country, in other countries, the most active groups are in Great Britain. Mm-hmm. And there are several at the MRC, at the ICRF, at various portions of the MRC, which is in different places. There are groups that have interest in other countries, some of which are very good, but don't have the resources to do it. I mean, there's a group in Italy that is beginning to work on the human genome, and the Italians don't have a great reputation in that area of science, and I'm beginning to realize why. And it's not that they're not good scientists, because when you see the individuals there, they're terrific. They're mainly trained in the U.S. or in Great Britain, but they don't have the resources, and the government structure of how research is funded is so different in Italy that they can't possibly do it the same way we do. There's a group there, there's a group in the Soviet Union that apparently is working on it that have a lot of reagents we gave them, though I don't know exactly what they're doing. There's a lot of discussion about the Japanese, but I think it's all discussion. I haven't really seen anybody there who's serious and hot into this area.
Go back to the instruments for a minute, if you would. You mentioned the 170,000 microscope that you were eyeing.
Yeah.
But what have you got in your lab? What would you like to get in the lab?
One of the things that is becoming very apparent is this kind of biology, like certain kinds of physics, is very high tech and it requires a lot of instrumentation, probably more so than my molecular biology has done in the last 20 years by many orders of magnitude. And we the kinds of things we have access to now, we have a robot that the Department of Energy bought us, and one of the areas that is just beginning to come into the forefront is automating a lot of these repetitive procedures. So we have that, which actually when we end up getting something like that, how you pay for it is never actually clear. So when you buy something like that, we kind of look and see, we put all these grant numbers on it, hope that half of them have some money left in them and we can buy it. And we have that. We have a number of complex gel apparatus for separating very large fragments of DNA. The Institute has a cell sorter, which was built by someone here, which we're now using to purify chromosomes individually by passing them through several laser beams as they come down through an orifice. And that's essentially the kind of high-tech equipment we have. Now, there are other things that we need. And the approach that I've taken is, when we need something, the first thing is to find out who else has one. Is there anybody in the area that has one? This microscope, for instance, is called a confocal microscope. And what it is it's a standard microscope that has a large laser on top. The laser beam goes down through the eyepiece, and rather than visually seeing it, the laser scans the image, and it digitizes it and puts it into a computer. And what one can do, and I'll show you some pictures, but the things that we're in the process of doing is determining some things about chromosome structure by, this is a set of human chromosomes. The gene we're looking at is labeled in yellow. This is what you would see visually, but once it's in the computer, you can then enlarge the chromosomes and measure various parameters. You know, we measure lengths and diameters. This is all done on the computer using the mouse, which we can, this is the gene we're looking at. And it allows you to determine a lot of different statistics and do some very precise things by essentially using the computer to analyze the image.
So it requires a microscope, a big laser, and a big computer system with several monitors to do the analysis. We don't have one, but I found a neurobiologist who does. And so we've ended up doing some of the work anyway, but really in the most difficult way possible. Is we only work from 10 at night to 6 in the morning when they're not using their microscope. And the postdocs in the lab that do it end up going up there. It requires completely disassembling the machine, because what we're doing is very different than what they're doing. Setting it up for our studies, doing the studies, and then putting it back together before morning. And making them, of course, incredibly angry. And it's partly an exercise in science, it's partly an exercise in interpersonal relationships to make sure we can keep them happy that we're not, you know, destroying their experiments. But we've been able to, in some ways, you know, I keep telling people we're doing this on a shoestring, because we're not a very big lab compared with some of the other places doing this. But it turns out to be fun, and I think we're doing quite well. The equipment for this kind of work, I'm not sure how the prices are decided, but it seems to just escalate as time goes on in terms of, you know, what one has to spend to get a machine to do this or that.
Yes. Yes. That's what Robert Hooke said to his colleagues. Okay, I think I'd like to switch you briefly into areas away from the science proper, and you mentioned that your wife in an earlier incarnation played a critical role in pointing you in some direction. Would you, can you just talk about your wife's background and what she does today and so on?
Well, she and I are almost exactly the same age. I think our birthdays are separated by about 7 weeks. She was born in the Bay Area around San Francisco. Her father is a businessman who works in downtown San Francisco. Her mother has been a homemaker. We come from very similar backgrounds. And she was the youngest of three children and came to UC San Diego as an undergraduate. Her interest in doing that was in mathematics at the time, and she has a, when she was deciding where to go to college, she found the school that had the best mathematics department that was in California, but not too close to home, and ended up coming to UCSD, and we actually met in a freshman calculus class. And she went through college in parallel with myself, got a degree in mathematics. At that time, we were very serious in deciding where we going to, we had kind of decided to go to the same place so we could be near one another. And we decided essentially to stay in San Diego at the same time. This is when I was deciding where to go to graduate school and medical school. She became a graduate student in mathematics at UCSD and finished a master's degree and was deciding whether or not to go on to finish her PhD. Now, unlike myself, who was very focused on doing research, she decided that she didn't really like doing research in mathematics. She liked teaching mathematics, but what a research mathematician does was not, she decided that it wasn't for her. But in addition to that, she actually is a quite talented musician. She's a lyric soprano. So she applied and was accepted to the graduate school in music and got a master's degree in music. And now really was a professional musician for all intents and purposes. When we were at the NIH, she had a faculty position at a college in the music department. And she performs quite a lot. She performed with a number of opera companies in Washington, D.C. As I said, had a faculty job there. And now here has started a number of groups. She's the director of something called the Orpheus Ensemble, which is a chamber music group that does Bach. It does Baroque music. And she both conducts the small orchestra, and then she sings. They do a lot of Bach cantatas, and she teaches music, teaches voice, and that's essentially her current interest. In that she essentially spends most of her time doing that. Though it's being supporting yourself as a musician is even more difficult than supporting yourself as a scientist. So.
Do you have children?
We have two children. We have an 8-year-old daughter and a 5-year-old son. And our daughter was born in Washington, and our son was born in San Diego. They both are very intelligent kids. My daughter, when she started kindergarten, was reading at about the 7th grade level. And my son is not quite as advanced in reading, but he's in kindergarten this year, and he's learning multiplication. We have them both in a private school here that is allows children to proceed at their own rate, because we couldn't see having them in a public school where they would really not be able. They would be learning their colors in kindergarten when they're already reading. So
mm-hmm.
That we're both again very serious about education, and that was very important to us.
Mm-hmm. What about recreation? Do you ever get out of the lab?
Yeah. It depends what do you mean by recreation. Well, I actually learned to ski several years ago. I had never been skiing in my life. And the story is that I was on a trip once. I was giving a seminar somewhere on the East Coast, and I told the lab that I wasn't going to be in on a particular day. And I came back a day early, and I walked in the lab. There was nobody there except for one technician. I said, "Where is everyone?" And she wouldn't tell me. And after a while, it turned out they all went skiing that day. And I, of course, was rather upset. And I told them, "Now, don't you ever do that again. But if you do, invite me." And so they did. And one of my postdocs, who was a ski instructor, taught me how to ski. And ever since then, I've been a real fanatic about it, and go several times a year, as a minimum. In addition to that, both my wife and I enjoy music a great deal. I play a number of musical instruments, none of them particularly well, but I studied piano when I was a high school student, teenager, and younger, and play the piano and organ and various other things. So we have a lot of music in our house. My wife's a very accomplished pianist. My daughter now is a very accomplished pianist. I play, but because my hours are not, I'm not home during the day and the kids go to bed early, I have an electronic synthesizer that I play, which can simulate virtually any instrument. It's not quite as nice as a grand piano, but you can use earphones. So I play the piano, I play the instrument quite a lot. And I also do a lot of building, both furniture making, and I recently built a room on our house, which is the first time I'd ever done anything like that. And I greatly enjoy manual labor, if you will, but making things. We make things in the lab, but the things we make you can't really see easily. We make DNA construction. I like to make furniture. Much of the furniture in our house I built, actually.
How does your typical day run?
My typical day now, in the present time, is that I would get to the lab, get up maybe 6:30 or 7, help get the kids off to school, get to the lab maybe at 8 or 8:30, And unfortunately, most of what I now do is talk on the phone, write papers, write grants, and meet with people. And that's, and then I'll have lunch and then work till maybe 5 or 6 and then go home. And the reason for that is not because I've run out of things to do, but with my two young children usually go to bed about 7:30 to 8. My wife is very strict about that, and if I don't get home early, I don't see them, and it's very important for me to see the kids. And then after the kids go to bed, sometimes if I have energy left, I'll do some reading or some writing at home. And if not, you know, I'll do some reading for pleasure or play the piano or something like that. That's quite different than 6 months ago, where I, 6 months ago I was actually doing experiments in the lab myself. And a lot of the thing that our lab is now working on, the Human Genome Project, is based immediately on vectors and techniques that I myself, with my own hands, made 6 months ago, which I'm very proud of because people think that I don't really work in the lab anymore.
So the Genome Project is really moving you in terms of what you do.
Yes, it is definitely changing the way my day goes.
Mm-hmm.
Partly because it's unfortunately it's the best use of my time. What I can do that people, that postdocs can't do, is I can get on the phone and call up Maynard Olson and I can negotiate for certain things that we need. Or I can arrange collaborations, or I can arrange information from others. And I can advise people on how they should proceed on their project. And while it's much more fun for me to be able to do the experiment, it's actually faster and more efficient for me to tell one of the postdocs how to do it, and he can go off and do it, and I can tell the next one. Or not tell them how to do it, but give them the benefit of my advice. I would much rather have her go out and do the experiment myself. I think it's more fun.
What do you think the story's going to be in 5 or 10 years? Where, do you know where you'd like to be?
You mean geographically?
No.
Or you mean in terms of how my day is spent? What I would like, and whether this can be done, you know, remains to be seen, is I would like to have more time to do my own experiments myself. And what I mean by that is the main projects that are going on, that are giving the results, that are funding the lab, that are the basis of the grants, the postdocs, are doing quite well. But there are occasionally these crazy ideas that one comes up with that are so far out, I can't get someone else to do it. It's something I'd really like to try, it probably won't work. And those are the things I'd like to have the time to do myself. And I think as time goes on, with luck, I can arrange things so I can do that. At least spend a couple days a week, half days a week doing something, and then have a technician that does, you know, follows the cells. The kinds of things, I mean, for instance, one of the problems we have with the genome project is how to purify chromosomes. If you look at them, they all look the same. They're not very different. The way we can purify them is using this cell sorter, this large machine, but it essentially purifies them based on size. And human chromosomes are small to large ones, but there's a lot that are exactly the same. So the idea that I came up with that probably won't work was people very frequently make hybrids. They engineer a cell that's a hamster cell, but it has one human chromosome. Hamster and human chromosomes are all the same. If we could engineer one where the chromosomes were of a very different size, it'd be easy to purify. So I found out that there's a something called a muntjac, which is a small barking deer. It's a primitive deer that they have at the San Diego Zoo. It only has 3 chromosomes, but they're huge chromosomes. And the idea is to fuse a human cell with a muntjac cell. And what you would have are these 3 immense chromosomes and a little teeny human one. So it would be easy to pick out the small human one. So we actually, a postdoc and I actually went down to the zoo. We got the people and they gave us some fibroblasts from the muntjac. We have them growing in the lab. And eventually, if I can find time, it's an experiment I'd like to try. So there's some things like that that are a little bit off the beaten track that they're pretty far out, but I think that would be fun.
Okay. One last question in a very different domain, and it's prompted by what I see up here. And I'd just like to get on in the record something about how you handle the documentation of what you do.
Okay. These notebooks here are all the notebooks that I've generated since I've had my own lab. And this is all my work, not the work of the people in the lab, but my personal work. And, I mean, as you can see, it's evolved. Because when I first started out, they just said data. And then, as I began being more specific, I changed it to the exact project that it was working on. And
there are about 40 of these.
There's about 40 of those. And these actually end off in 688. Now, the reason for that is, number one, many of the most important things are now going on in the lab. And what I've tried to impinge on people in the lab is that they need to be very organized about their data. Some of these notebooks, some of them are very poor in terms of how the data is kept. Some of them, the earlier ones, are very good in that they have table of contents. I probably can't show you that because these are really pretty sketchy. These are very simple experiments. A date, if you're lucky. They're loose leaf pages. What we've been going to more is something like this, which is using computer annotation.
Graphic, yeah.
Everything from here on is actually not in notebooks. It's in the computer.
Mm-hmm.
And
what about grant applications and all that sort of stuff? What do you do with that?
The grant applications are, there's a file cabinet in the other room where all the grants are kept, the final forms. So they're all, even the ones that don't get funded are all kept there, as well as now they're all kept in the computer. I find that most useful because I can plagiarize for myself very easily to pull sections out and cut and paste them together. Everybody in the lab has this system, and in most cases they've done what I told them they should do, not what I actually did, which is be very organized about how they keep the data. But actually, those notebooks up there are from my postdoc work,
there
which I still have.
20 or 30 of those.
And the ones on the left, in the black edged ones, are from my graduate work. So I have virtually all the records from every experiment that I've ever done.
What about correspondence?
Correspondence. I've recently gotten much more organized than I used to be, in that I have files in the filing cabinet here with all the correspondence from a particular year. And I have a secretary now, so she actually is very good about keeping those records up.
How long have you had a secretary?
Oh, about 6 months.
Okay.
Yeah, it is very... The two most difficult things to get are, number one, space, and number two, a secretary. And that
the
was
secretary funded out of the grants, essentially?
The secretary will be funded out of my grant, but right now it's a present.
Present
from the Institute. So she actually is the only thing funded by the Institute. So it comes out of Institute coffers. And
is that a function of seniority?
It's a function of... it's a function of partly reward and partly complaining. The reason I have a secretary is, in fact, because I was telling, which is true, that there's so much of this routine stuff for me to do, I can't possibly do it. I'm going to quit and go, you know, become a real estate salesman. And after enough of that, and suitable threats and suitable interpersonal skills, ended up having a part-time secretary.
Mm-hmm. Have outside offers been a necessary part of your life, or has it run with publications and research results?
No. It unfortunately, I wish it had it, but I don't know if this is true everywhere, but
just doing good work is not sufficient. I mean, it's necessary to have suitable pressure to exert on the institution. I wish it were not the case, but...
So how many, you've been here half a dozen years, and yeah. how many times have you had an outside offer drama?
Oh, probably twice, I think. I think twice is really the thing. I mean, it's part of the way things operate. I'm not sure that that's the case in most places, including at this institution, which is the way it is, and historically has a long history of people coming and going. That's the way things have worked. I'm not sure it's always actually good. I actually think it's a waste of time. You can spend a lot more time doing the science. But
how long is your contract for now?
It's for 3 years now.
Oh, no.
It's a rolling contract, though. So every year it's renewed for the following 3 years.
Okay. It's a three-year early warning contract.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. Okay. And do you think the outside offer drama is necessarily bound into the scenery looking forward as well?
I think it probably is at this particular institution. I mean, in some ways, the outside offer drama is not just, I mean, it's serious. It's, the thing is, what am I doing here? I could go here and I could really, you know, be left alone and do the experiment. So it's not just putting pressure on the institute. It's really serious thoughts about where is the best place to do the science, both scientifically and professionally and from a personal point of view. And of course, the grass always looks greener in other places. But I have a feeling that that's probably not going to go away. I think that's just...
If you, just to draw to a close, if in, at least as an armchair experiment, you were going to move, and the offer is from wherever you want,
mm-hmm.
where are the one or two, can you instantly identify the one, two places?
Well, there actually is a balance between two opposing attractions. One attraction is to be in a place which is intellectually the most stimulating, meaning a concentration of other people who have similar interests and enthusiastic look, not necessarily doing the same thing. I don't relish being in a place where everybody is doing something very similar. I like being in a place where there are very smart people doing very diverse things. The other is what one likes from a personal point of view. And the kinds of things that now are becoming very valuable to me are, number one, to live close to where you work. And, you know, I used to, a year ago, come back every night or come back on weekends or commute back and forth. And now I can't do that. There's too much traffic and congestion in the area. So being able to live close to where you work, to me, would be a big selling point. And also being in a place that is not just nice, but kind of a focus and a growing place. I keep thinking about what the Salk Institute must have been like when it was first started here. And what happened was that Jonas Salk was going to start an institute. He wanted to put it in a place that would have a university nearby, so it would have the intellectual attachment, but it was really a new place, and he wanted to start something new. So he came to San Diego, which no one had ever heard of at the time, started an institute, and somehow managed to attract these incredibly visible, famous, well-known scientists who were right on the cutting edge of their field at that time, and he got them all to come here at once. So you could think, if one was going to go somewhere new, you'd only go there if there were other people also going there, kind of build up something.
So it wouldn't be an established place.
Well, it could. It could, but I think one would be looking for an intellectual focus.
If we limit ourselves to establish places and print all these things, put all these things into the computer, what does it print out? What are they?
Oh, I mean, I think there are kind of two possibilities. One is the Harvard, MIT, Columbia kind of area, which is a very well-established world center. The other would be something, and I keep thinking of places like the Santa Fe Institute, which is not really a laboratory, but it's kind of a new idea in a new place that is getting a lot of very good people interested in it. And I kind of always enticed by that. You know, you think, well, maybe they really have the right idea. But it's hard to know.
Very good. Thank you very much, Cliff.
Thank you.
We're just...